guys love rig rundowns. We love rig rundowns. Love please like and subscribe so we can keep doing these rig rundowns.
It would mean a lot.
Hey everyone, this is Chris Keysport from Your Guitar. We're hanging out in downtown Nashville at Easy Eye Studio. Long time coming. We wanted to visit this place for a long time, and the reason we're here is to talk to Barry. Barry, how
are
you doing?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing very well. I'm very excited to talk to you. You're one of my favorite guitar players. I'm not being a sicko fan, and I'm also not trying to just butter you up. You were one of my favorite players.
Thank you.
And you're so prolific. You know, you're part of the Easy Eye family. With your records coming out, Gravity Freeze should be out, or it's coming out soon, depending on when this video drops. But you've also been doing work in the studio for like the Easy Eye releases that aren't related to your band. So tell me about how that all started in your connection with Dan in the studio here.
Well, I met Dan and Pat in 2023. I did a couple of years playing in Liam Gallagher's band. Well, Bonehead wasn't well, and he needed to take a bit of time out. So I filled in for Bonehead while he was getting himself right, and I knew that me and Dan had a few mutual friends, and we were on the same bill at a festival in Milan in Italy, so I thought, I'm going to go and say hi, and we bumped into each other backstage, and just got talking, and he said, I'll come to the hotel and have a drink after we've all played, you know, so I watched some of the show, and it was really cool, and then we went back and hung out for a bit and just got talking, and Dan did say, I'd love to get you over for a session, and I thought, well, I'm sure he's really busy, so it might not happen, or might not happen immediately, but 3 months later, I got a text message from Alan Parker, his main engineer, and just said, could you come over for a session? And me and my drummer friend Malcolm Cato came over and did Jeremy Albino's album.
Okay.
And that's kind of how it started, really. And then manager Rich spoke to Easy Eye saying we'd been recording some albums in the UK, and they heard them, they were interested in putting them out, and that's kind of how it got rolling. We got called back for a few more sessions last year. We did Robert Finley and Miles Kane, and then I was asked about doing a tour last year with the Keys, joining them on Extra Guitar.
Yeah.
So I jumped at that and did a tour of the US with them, and then did a bit more work in the studio with Dan then as well during downtime.
Yeah, he's maximizing the contract that he signed with you. Again, like, I don't know how those work nowadays, but yeah, he's putting you to work.
It's a great opportunity though, and you know, as a British musician to get to come to Nashville and play, it's not as if the town's short of good musicians.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, Perry always jokes that the pizza guy delivering our pizza is probably a better musician
than
one of us.
Johnny worked here said, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of quality, classy musicians here. So to get us to come out here and work is a bit of a dream anyway. And yeah, it's just been so much fun working with cool people and having a good time.
Yeah.
Working in beautiful places like this.
Now, you had spent some other time in Tennessee recently. You got to spend some time in Memphis. How was that?
Yeah, on Monday. Yeah, our record was being pressed there, so we went to the plant and saw our record coming off the machines, which was amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, especially as a British band, and to get to go to Memphis anyway is a bit of a pilgrimage for the history. But then see your record being pressed there.
Yeah.
You know, we had time to stop into Stax Studios as well. We got a bit of a tour. And so yeah, it was a brilliant day. So it's been nice to have a couple of days to do this in between doing a studio session last week and then we're starting the rehearsals with the Keys.
Now, did you get to see Isaac Hayes' big gold Cadillac that spins?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I sent it to my managers, you know, something if you might get a few ideas, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, that's hell of a motor. Loads of other cool stuff in there, like sort of geeking out. They had the Les Paul and the Boomerang wah pedal that did Shaft, you know.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. Booker T's Hammond that did Green Onions.
And it's such a historic place, and I know that people in Cleveland will get, you know, upset, but I think that's where the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame should be, rather than Cleveland. I think it should be in Memphis.
It, isn't it?
That'll be my opinion.
Yeah, it was amazing day, really. Just well worth the drive down there. You
know? Yeah. Well, excellent. Well, what brings us here today is to talk about Gravity Freeze, like I alluded to. I wanted to bring that up and then also kind of connect it to the record that you did with Malcolm, Electric War, because wasn't that written and recorded around kind of conjunctive?
Yeah, two different studios at different times, but I was writing some of those songs around the same time and feeling like they were going to two different projects. Me and Lewis had already done a collaboration album with Malcolm previous called Quatermass 7, and it went really well, so we thought we should do another one. And I had some ideas of songs that I wanted to take to Malcolm and get his input and record them in his studio, because he produced that record and mixed it as well. I mean, Malcolm has his own band, Heliocentrics. He also does a lot of production and does drums for other people as well. So we work together when we can, and you know, it was just a really cool collaboration because we've been big fans of his for a long time. So I was writing some songs and taking them to Malcolm. We started making that record in Malcolm's, and we were overdubbing their mixing. And by the time we were at the mixing stage, Malcolm was sending me mixes, we'd already recorded the main part of the Gravity Freeze record in another studio called Rat Salad Studios in North London with my producer friend Rupert Liddon, who I'd worked with on a couple of different projects, from a bit of music for film scores to sort of library projects and other stuff. And we were getting good guitar sounds. Rupert started out as a guitarist, and we were liking the sounds we were getting in there. And I did a soundtrack project for a documentary. And then I got my friend Tony in to play drums, because we need some drums on the documentary. And we also liked the drum sounds in that studio. So we thought we should make this record here.
Yeah.
But it was a tiny room, basically a mixing room.
Huh.
We turned the sofa on its side so we could get the drum set in. Me and Lewis played guitar and bass into amp simulators while we were tracking, so we could all play live, then re-amp those basic takes, then overdubbed afterwards.
Wow.
And that's so, because we were liking all the sounds in the room, and we thought we didn't really want to risk trying to go somewhere else in case we were chasing what we got there. So that's how we made that record. So
yeah, cool. It's so cool because, again, the timeline's similar, but the energy and kind of the personality of the records are so different. And I'm sure that's obviously with Malcolm versus Tony, but also the stuff you did in Electric War is expansive, jammy.
Yeah, we did a bit more improv with Malcolm, which we wanted to do because okay. That's something we hadn't really done, me and Lewis hadn't done. And that's a big part of Malcolm's music as well as composition. He does both. And we wanted to see where Malcolm would take the songs. And sometimes we sort of deconstructed them and built them back up, and it was always for the better.
Yeah.
He got new things out of us and stuff that was really exciting and took us to new places. And we didn't have a record, we'd not had a record that sounded like that before. With the songs I was writing that became Gravity Freeze, I kind of felt like their identity was kind of defined quite quickly. Mm. I kind of felt like I know where this record needs to go. Spoke to Rupert about recording it because we were enjoying recording there. So the songs sort of sat into the two camps quite easily. Mm. Kind of two sides of the same era, really,
yeah.
I suppose.
Now, what were you trying to go for with Gravity Freeze? What was your kind of vision, and what was your muse speaking to you?
I don't know. It was a little bit more song-based. The record we made before, just titled as Little Barry, the one before Death Express we'd made, and it was released in 2017, and then our drummer Virgil sadly passed away unexpectedly. So that kind of derailed the band for a while. Then we started working with Malcolm as just a way to get working at first. But we did do a few gigs as Little Barry in 2019 before the pandemic happened with Tony on drums. So we'd already started playing with Tony.
Familiar.
And we did a tribute to Danny Kirwan for Fleetwood Mac with Tony on drums as well. That was the first time we played live since Virgil passed. And we got our friend Joe Hollick from the band Wolf People to play second guitar because we needed two lead guitars for that. So we'd already been playing a little bit with Tony anyway. And I just felt like it was a little bit more song-based, that record. And the Death Express record, it was a double album. There's quite a lot of songs, but for some reason we felt like we needed to put it all out at the same time and sort of draw a line in the sand with that time. We didn't know what was around the corner, but it was just felt right to do. And then it was quite a high-paced record, kind of raw, a bit more garagey, but still kind of funky. And I like the idea of doing a long record, almost like the Beastie Boys, Paul's Boutique, or Check Your Head, but from more of an R&B garage bandy sort of point of view, really. That sounds a bit daft, but that was kind of the basic idea. And then I think with this album, it's a bit more melodic, more song-based than Electric War, I think. But I don't know, the songs just kind of happened quite naturally, I guess just inspiration, and, you know, things evolve. You get, you know, your interests go into different areas, but it's just the way the songs came out, I suppose. It sort of happened quite naturally, really.
The one I think that has the most overlap in that on Gravity Freeze is Lugging Heart.
Yeah, because that wasn't intended to be a long song. But we carried on jamming because we knew we'd hit a good take. So when we'd finished the arrangement of the song, we just carried on for about another 3.5 minutes because it felt good. And no one said anything. We were all bunched up in that room just playing. And when we got to the end of it, we were like, we'd done a good take here. And I overdubbed a couple of other guitars. Tony added a bit of percussion.
Yeah.
And then I got my two friends, Frida and Holly, who sang backing vocals in Liam's band, to do a backing vocal. And then we had a cool song, and it felt good to have a one stretched out track on the record, although that wasn't the original plan, it just happened.
It's kind of like with the Stones and Can't You Hear Me Knocking, like they had that original idea, and then there's four more minutes of it.
Yeah, it turned out into kind of a cool, as Rupert said, a kind of funky boogie, you know, sort of good fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just really liked the way Lewis and Tony were playing, and that just made me want to carry on. And then I overdubbed a couple of guitars and we had something, you know.
What's the idea with the phrase or the two words, Gravity Freeze?
Oh, it's a song about, I don't know what the name of it is for the US, but have you ever had or heard of sleep paralysis?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I seem to get it quite a lot. So the song was about, it was the nickname I gave to that.
Huh.
Sort of strange things happen where you're sort of half awake, half dreaming, and the song was about that feeling, you know, where you sort of freeze over and you feel like you can't move, and then you're dreaming, and then you sort of find your way out of it, or strange things have happened, strange dreams happen, like walking through walls and things like that, and it's quite a surreal temporary state, you know. So that song stands out from the others, I guess, just, you know, I just like the title, so I thought it'd make a good album title.
Yeah, and going back to working with Malcolm in the Electric War and just your overall approach to the instrument, I find so commendable is that you're so patient with the instrument when you come to playing guitar. And so you're talking about deconstructing songs. I'm sure you're pulling back guitar parts when you're doing compositions. Where did you get the confidence to maybe not, because a lot of times with guitar players, myself, or even in conversations right now, where you find yourself having to fill the air with notes or words, but you have such a pause and confidence where you let the notes ring out and it's just beautiful and it keeps the listener ready for the next bit.
Oh, thanks. I think I do it more now maybe than I used to, but I guess the first thing that made me start to think about that is when I started to sing. I mean, I'm not the greatest singer in the world, but I started singing just so I could finish songs and be a bit more self-sufficient, really. Mm. But you realise when I realised when I started singing that it put my guitar playing into context, because I played around the vocal. And the person who made me want to learn to play guitar was John Squire, and I felt like he always, from the Stone Roses, I felt like he always, his guitar weaved around the vocal in a way, and sort of complemented the vocal and supported it. And that was a big inspiration for me. And also people like Chuck Berry and Jimi Hendrix doing that.
Yeah.
And playing in a trio, you have to learn to strip things back, because if you start off all out, you've got nowhere to go. It's trusting the space. But I feel like it's taken me time to do that. And Malcolm taught me more about that as well. Huh. And also because we became quite a, when we were doing the Def Express record, that we became quite a powerful sort of raw three-piece band. And we did leave space, but I felt like sometimes we beat the audience over the head with sound for an hour. With Malcolm, he kind of taught us to sort of lay back and trust the space, trust being quietening down and using more dynamic. And sometimes me not playing at all, you know, I just sing.
Yeah, there's moments. Play.
And you realise you say more by, it's, you know, whatever people say is a cliche or whatever, but I realise I was saying more by not playing sometimes and just trusting it. And also learning to mix myself more, not just play at one velocity.
Yeah.
So when you do dig in more, things leap out more, or sometimes you have more power by bringing things down, and that's the thing that Malcolm really taught me and Lou, I think.
Yeah, Lewis, I gotta say, like, you yield a lot to Lewis, and it reminds me, and not that the music's anything similar, but it reminds me of like Jesus Lizard or you know, in a way Tool, but in the sense that the bass is leading the song. I know it's a rhythm instrument, but I'm saying there's parts where there's songs where they start out and you don't even play guitar for the first minute.
Yeah. It's got to be whatever's right for the arrangement, really. And I quite like that, because it means the guitar can have more impact, like with the song Miles of Road or whatever. That it's mainly driven by the bass and the drums, and the guitar kind of just pops in and out. But it says enough that way. I've never been the sort of person who fills songs out with a lot of rhythm guitar. It's just not. I was sometimes trying to avoid that. Keep out of the. Although there's some records I really like that do that. I was just trying to keep out that and let the rhythm section breathe a bit more. And even though we're playing with a rock band's gear, try not to approach it like a rock band in a way. Mm.
Do you think some of that might have added to your vocabulary or your patience based on, you know, you've been in so many different bands, you've filled in roles, you know, with Liam, obviously the, there's just a lot of bands that you've stepped into now, the Black Keys, where you're seeing the bigger picture rather than I'm a guitar player and I'm going to show you what I can do.
Yeah, you've got to play for the song and play for the band. And also, when you're working with different people, you learn a lot, because, especially in the studio, people will be arranging songs in a way that you wouldn't think of. Mm. Or they'll be using sounds, or they'll be using a microphone or an amp or a guitar setup that you didn't think of. You're like, wow, that sounds really cool. Or you're always going to learn stuff, and then that goes into your own music. And playing with other people, it brings sides of you out that you wouldn't think of if you were in the studio or at home making a demo of a new song of your own. And I'm hoping that it gives you new things. That one thing I think as an artist you've got to be conscious of when you've made a few albums is to not slip into the same habits or the same formulas and stuff. So working with other people, you know, gives you a fresh perspective, and hopefully you do take some of those things away, whether it's conscious or subconscious. You know.
How do you avoid getting into the pitfalls of, like you said, muscle memory when it comes to approaching the guitar?
I don't know. I don't know if I always do. You kind of hope you do, but I'm always looking for new things or trying to refine things that I've already learned, because, you know, I'm never happy with where I'm at with it. And I don't think you ever will be, and that's the beauty
Yeah, you can always learn.
Yeah, and you're always trying to play the things you've known for a long time better, or look for something new. And you know, there's lots of guitar styles that I love, and there's lots of musicians who do things that I don't know how to do.
Yeah.
Or I haven't learned how to do, or and just, yeah, just trying to listen to different things and drawing different inspiration, really.
Is there anything that you've been recently working on or incorporating into your own playing that's kind of a new arrow in the quiver?
Well, I think it's been gradual, but I realize I play more with my fingers than I used to. I play a mixture of fingers and pick, you know.
Yeah, I noticed in that intro you kind of were picking, but then you'd also rake the strings.
Yeah, because it's a different sound, you know, between, because it's a different, you know, it's either the plastic pick or your fingers or...
Yeah, just go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I just play quietly, but... You know, if I played a riff with a, you know. Or you can, I felt like it's good to create different dynamic, especially when you're the only guitar player in a band. So it was good to not have everything at the same volume level. So if you want to self-accompany yourself as a guitar player, you know, you might want something to sit more in the background, maybe like a chord voice, for example.
Yeah.
I don't know. And I try and get a bit of rhythm in things. A lot of times I play guitar on my own at home. So I'd be, you know, like. Oh, wrong chord there. But that's sort of different level. So you can use a mixture of sort of dynamic and where you are pitch-wise on the guitar to create the illusion of more than one instrument. Or sometimes that's what we do to cover if we've done overdubs on the record or something, you know, because when live it's just you. So there's ways to get different sounds, or just playing around different parts of the string. It's going to be tighter here, so you're going to get a different sound. It's going to be kind of softer and plummier up here.
I noticed you don't, and with just here now, and then also the videos I've watched and seen you perform live, is not many bar chords are in, at least when it comes to Little Barry and stuff.
I can't play them. I always found it really uncomfortable.
But you found a way to express.
Well, I saw the thumb technique from seeing people like Jimi Hendrix, but also Steve Cropper sometimes playing it, or I think Paul Weller from The Jam, Pete Townsend sometimes using that from watching clips when I was a teenager. But I always found that massively uncomfortable. I remember trying to play Sex Pistols songs as a kid because I loved Steve Jones' guitar sound.
Yeah.
And after half a song of that, it was so uncomfortable. And when I realised you can cover the same strings, and I realised I could move around quicker for things I wanted to do, like switch between rhythm guitar and single notes.
Yeah, because by
being in this position. So. So I didn't have to move around. It was kind of a more efficient use of your hands, you know. I could get more voices out. Just easier to move around for me, really.
Yeah.
And stuff. So that's just the way that happened. And it just felt like an anchor, easier way to grip the guitar and have a hold on it, you know. Mm. Really.
No, I stuff that you have your hands on more, like Little Barry stuff and your collaborations with Malcolm, is are you guys playing to like a click or anything like that? Or
no.
Is it just you guys performing in a room and just kind of going with the feel of it?
Yeah, I mean, quite often when I'm doing sessions, there'll be clicks, but not here, actually, which is good. I mean, quite often, though, if there is a click, I'll just not have it in my headphones.
You know,
try and play without it. But I understand why people do it for editing or whatever, but... For the music that I do and we do, we don't really need it. If it speeds up a bit or it slows down, if the music feels right, I don't question it. Because a lot of those old records, we don't question it. And loads of them speed up.
Yeah, like you guys, and it's almost just letting it be a natural, organic thing rather than a machine.
Sometimes I do think it's an important part of the music. Sometimes it has to come up a bit to feel right.
Yeah.
It's not always meant to be at pure time, you know.
Yeah.
I don't think. I think sometimes the change in tempo is as important as the change in tone or a change in decibels or anything. You
know? Yeah, it's just another way to inflict another mood.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, but each to their own. I understand why people do it, but I'd rather not, personally.
Well, right on. I know people are here to talk about your gear And so this is kind of an amalgamation of Little Barry touring gear, specifically overseas here, but then also what you're going to be using with the Black Keys, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so talk to me about this gold top.
Well, this is fairly new. I bought this from the Gibson garage or garage.
Yeah.
Last year, because I needed another guitar for touring. And so it's I think it's a Murphy Lab model, like a 55 gold okay. top. When I bought it, it didn't have the Bigsby, but they kindly fitted it because that's kind of an important part of what I do.
Yeah, so you love the 5-speed.
Yeah, so it's like they fitted that for me. But I went in there just to have a look and met a guy, Scott Wasnack, in there. Me and my manager went in there, we got chatting to him. And I got trying out a bunch of these P90 Les Pauls because I thought P90 is my favourite pickup really anyway. And mainly playing like a 330 or a Casino. Mm. It's like my main Gibson or Epi guitar. But I thought maybe a solid body might be better for touring. Easier to travel around with. It's just kind of smaller, practical as well. Mm-hmm. Like smaller case to be carting around. And I really like this one. And I ended up getting it from, and I didn't do anything to it. They fitted the Bigsby apart from, the neck was pretty big and kind of bigger than some of the old guitars I remember. So I took it to my guy, Rob Wells at Night Guitars in Surrey in the UK. And he slimmed the neck down to a similar profile as my old Les Paul Custom.
Oh, nice.
Which just meant, because I play my thumb a lot, it just meant I could play this stuff up here more easily. So they're the only changes, the pickups are the factory ones. The only other change I made was the strings, where I've got kind of a custom set of strings.
Yeah, tell me about those.
I got more and more into flat wound strings over the years, partly because of my friend Tom Brennick, who I met when he was writing and producing Charles Bradley and he was in his touring band. Mm. And Tom always played a harmony guitar with flat wounds and he had this gorgeous sound. And
And
I realised that the flat wound sound was the sound of a lot of records. I was pretty late to it, really. And I tried a few generic sets of flats that weren't too heavy, like an 11-gauge set, but they always came with a wound third, which made bending a bit difficult for me in certain songs. And so I spoke to Pyramid about making me a custom set of flats with a plain G, so I could still be a bit more Chicago, a bit more country.
Yeah.
With it. So it meant that I could still bend those strings around, but I could still get the cool, that clunky sound that I sort of like, because I've always felt I've got kind of a clunky style, you know, but it was like, just get that nice chug on the low strings, and I like that. Just like, I feel like that was a sound that I liked, and it kind of leaves a bit more space. You get good definition with a flat wound string, I think, but also you don't get the overtones and the extra resonance, so it kind of lets the rhythm section still breathe through a bit. And
yeah.
I just like the sound, you know. So I think more guitars will end up with them. It's sort of a bit 50-50 at the moment with those, but.
I'll pull them out here, is what are the gauges then? I know the straight G, but then looks like 11.
Yeah, I think it's like a standard 11 set. So 11, 14, 18, 28, 38, 48.
Okay.
And that's kind of a cool, for me anyway, that's a cool sort of right in the middle thing. You know, I've got a bigger archtop guitar and it's got like 12 gauge set with a wound third, because that's right for that guitar. And I've got an old K Red Devil that has a wound G because it just sounds right. Mm. I tried putting a plain one on that and it just didn't seem appropriate sort of thing. But to be right in the middle of trying to get the best of both worlds and for touring, I've been playing with these. And Pyramid been really cool. They made them for me pretty quickly and sent them over, which is cool, from Germany. So
I appreciate that you're willing to let the instrument tell you what it wants versus, you know, because like there's a lot of players and myself can fall into this pattern is like, well, I'm electric. All 11s, you know, or if it's based on a certain scale length, but you're letting the instrument tell you, like, hey, I don't want this wound G, or I do, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's like the only guitar I've got with a set of 10-gauge strings on is I've got a Parts Fender Esquire made up, but I put a set of 10s on that so I could try and, not that I'm not, you know, a proper country guitar player, but just so I could try some of those more bendy things and get a bit of that snap out of it. So I put, you know, quite a light set of, like, just 1046 on that, but then if I've got an old archtop guitar, I might do 12 to, what is it, 54, or whatever those sets are, because it feels right, and stuff. So, yeah, I think it depends on the guitar and what you want from it.
Yeah.
There's no rules, though, really. You can just do your own thing, I think.
Well, do you want to grab another guitar? I know you got one over here, the ES.
Yeah. Well, this is the guitar that I've used a lot with the And I used it on the Keys tour last year. I mean, one thing I noticed straight away is that this is strung with the flats as well, but
okay.
This guitar is quite a bit brighter, and that one's got a higher output, and that's kind of a darker sounding guitar. But so this one will be might be a bit brighter. But I've got the old ES-345 at home that I use on a lot of stuff.
That black one?
That was refinished years and years ago. Yeah. That's why I got it cheap. But I wasn't sure about taking it out on the road anymore, so I saw this. Well, basically, the story behind this guitar is I went to buy another 335, and I picked this up by mistake. And I was like, wow, this is amazing. I realized it was more money. I picked up the wrong guitar.
How it works.
I was like, wow, this is brilliant. And I was like, what am I going to do?
Yeah.
I didn't know what to do, so I rang up my mate, Mike Moore, because I was playing with Liam's band at the time. Mike's like the lead guitarist and MD in Liam's band. I said, Mike, what do I do? This guitar's like quite a bit more. And he says, I think you know what you need to do. So I just bought it, you know. But it was the right move. So yeah, more of an open sound. So more bright on that bridge pickup. I mean, this is all right. So quite a bit brighter. That's an old Bigsby that I found that. That's a vintage one, like okay. 60s, maybe early 70s.
Do you do anything to the spring or the arm or anything to make it more for you?
Yeah, I always bend the arms.
Okay.
So you just sort of put some weight on them. Sometimes just to get... I mean, that one's not so bad because it doesn't have a pick guard.
Okay.
But when you've got the pick guard on, if you bend the arm, you've got a bit more height, then you're not going to hit it. So I can still get quite a decent...
Although they take the pick guard off for you.
I like the pick guard, though. Because I've got used to resting on it with my fingers over the years. For some reason, with that guitar, it's okay. But with that NES guitar, I'm used to it being there, and I quite like the look of it.
Yeah.
I sometimes play quite a bit from playing up here. I'll rest my fingers here. It means you can get a good... This has got like a soft tension spring in it, so it does... Oh, the pitch quite a bit more. But,
Yeah, being a country fan, I know that you can kind of get close to steel
yeah.
stuff.
Yeah. You can get a bit of that.
Yeah.
It's just it's very expressive. Yeah, it's just a nice sound.
Hey everybody, I'm John Bollinger with Premier Guitar. So, as many of you know, D'Addario's been a longtime friend of PG, sponsoring Rig Rundowns, and they're a longtime friend of all the players with their Players Circle Rewards. I've been using it for years, and essentially, they will reward you for the gear you buy. Open it up, look inside, there's a reward number. It's free and easy to sign up for. And as soon as you sign up, you immediately get some reward points just for putting your name in. After a while, you accumulate enough where you can buy more of this fantastic D'Addario gear. So as a Players Circle Rewards member, you get discounts on custom products and merch, you get free shipping, and you get a discount on the gear you're buying with your points or free gear, depending on that. And if you're charitable, you could donate your Players Reward points for musical education. So collect those points, buy the great gear, and let's get back to more rundowns.
Now for Gravity Freeze or even Electric War, would you say you had a particular instrument you leaned on more for those sessions?
Depends on the song, really. I think okay, so Loving Hurt, I used my Black Beauty Les Paul for quite a bit of it. My Epiphone Casino's on that record quite a lot. And then the custom built white guitar I had. And then I used a couple of other things, K Red Devils on that. That's got a really kind of donkey sound with the flats with the wound G. Mm. I used that quite a bit on some stuff. But yeah, it just depends on the song, really. Casino's on it quite a lot because that just happened to be around. For some reason, I was taking that out the door instead of the 330.
Yeah.
And we had a bunch of different amps in the studio. Like I took some of my own down. I took my Brown Super 62 Fender Super combo. But Rupert also had an old AC30 and he had a Blackface Bandmaster, and I've got a custom built amp built by my friend Frank Cook from London that's his company's called JPF. He built a small run of amps, and he built me the only 212 combo that he built, and he built it with KT66 tubes, like the early Marshalls. It's got that kind of early, slightly more hi-fi Marshall kind of tone where you get that really musical feedback. I use that quite a lot. We put loads of the bass through that on the album as well. Oh, actually. Wow.
Now, I know that normally you're a Fender amp guy. You have
mainly. Yeah.
Early 60s stuff is kind of your favorite spot right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then I know you fool around with some Gibson amps too.
Yeah, I bought a couple of smaller ones recently from my mate Jim Sweet, who has a shop in London. I got a Gibson GA18 Explorer, like a Tweed 110, and I got a GA6, which I think is a 10 as well. That's like the Explorer's from 1960 and the GA6 is from 57. GA6 distorts more, but in a really cool way. It sounds pretty wild.
Yeah.
It's super cool. So yeah, little amps are good for recording. Like the last few sessions I've done down at Malcolm's, I've been taking the little Gibsons down.
Okay.
They sound really good. So maybe for recording I use those more, but for live, my old white piggyback Bassman is
kind of the one.
Really. Sometimes I used to, if I wanted to be louder or it's a bigger stage, I would run the Bassman and daisy chain it with the Brown Super. So you've got 212s in the closed back cab and then the...
That'll bark.
210s in the... Yeah, it's really good, actually. It's a nice sound, but...
Do you ever mess... I know that you talked about your friend building kind of a Marshall-based amp. Have you ever dealt with Marshalls?
Yeah, I did early on because a lot of my early guitar heroes, you know, I got into, you know, Jimi Hendrix and then Cream and the early Jeff Beck group and the Blues Breakers and Mick Ronson. So I wanted, like, a Plexi Marshall... When I was a teenager, I bought really cheap. I bought an early 1970s Marshall 50-watt head, which is totally extravagant to just put in your bedroom as a teenager.
Yeah.
I occasionally take it out of a 412 cabinet. And I used Marshalls a lot when I played with the Primal Scream because that was the sound.
Mm.
You know, it's kind of going for more of like a sort of, what's that, MC5 kind of guitar sound, you know. And they were cool, but I think for my own music, I was always more of a Fender amp guy. I realized a bit later on, really, that... But yeah, I like those early Marshalls. They're excellent, but they're not cheap anymore. It also just means bigger stuff when you're trying to lug things around. And for the sort of level we play at, 212 Bassman is enough for me, really. But yeah, all those amps from that period are cool, though.
Right on. I know that we have a Jazzmaster here we want to check out.
Yeah, it's not mine, but it's Dan's. He's kindly...
Because the Jazzmaster is a tool that you use quite often.
Yeah, I got into them sort of... Kind of unintentionally, really. When I worked in a vintage guitar store in the UK...
That was a dangerous job, I bet.
Yeah, it was. I mean, although things were... See, this is set for Dan, you see. It's a bit low, but it's come off now. But, yeah, it was. But I did get my 330 out of there.
Okay.
Which I still got. That was the best thing I got out of there. But that's where I first discovered these, because I remember us having two Slabboard Jazzmasters that were nearly mint in the brown cases.
Mm.
And I just plug one into a Fender amp and really liked it. And I realized that obviously it's brighter than the Gibson. I was mainly grown up on playing a Gibson guitar, but I liked the sounds in it. And I liked just sort of that middle sound was a good R&B. It's just a... Cool, I like that sound, you know. Because a lot of my heroes are playing them, like Jay Maskis or Kevin Shields, making quite a sonic, a beautiful kind of melodic sonic assault with them, really. But I got into them with a cleaner sound. I realised how good the trem is. Really nice trem. Really useful and... Good kind of country tone
man,
on the back there. And then the front pickup. Just loads of cool sounds in there, and it's really like good for an R&B thing, or almost like a Who type thing, you know.
Kind of even gets with that kind of chord you're using is kind of almost Rickenbacker type.
Yeah. And it's a good kind of jangle machine. Jay Maskis was doing as much of that as he was the kind of heavy fuzz as well. But just a really, and I just got in with the way it was laid out, and just it felt a bit more familiar for someone who's used to a Gibson, having a higher up bridge, simple toggle switch, and that, and I don't know, I just like them.
You mess with the phase switch? The upper bout?
Like, not so much, it's a nice warm sort of rhythm sound, but I tend to just use it there. But it's a nice tone though. It's a little darker, you know, but it's cool. Yeah, this is a really good one. And also, I mean, Dan's got a thing in here to mute it, but you can get all those cool feedbacky sounds out of that. And sometimes I'll play behind the bridge and
do some Sonic Youth. And
Yeah, I love it when seeing those clips of Thurston like bending the neck against the amp. Sounds amazing. But yeah, I guess I played it in a bit more of an old-fashioned way, but my guitar sounds pretty similar to this one.
Now, we had talked off camera before rolling, is that you bonded with this, you talked about having like a T-style back home that you had some smaller strings on, Esquire, you said?
Yeah.
But not a Strat. Not a Strat, you haven't bonded with the Strat.
I've had a few Strats over the years because I liked it when other people played them. You know, like obviously Jimi Hendrix and then Johnny Marr, John Squire, Michael Corelli from Can, I really liked, Richard Lloyd. You know, then like, you know, Ike Turner, Buddy Guy, Johnny Guitar Watson, all that sort of stuff. Otis Rush. Amazing. So when other people were playing Strats, I really liked it. And then I loved the look of the old ones, you know. And I had a chance to buy a 63 refinished blue Strat years ago, and I bought it, and I had to sell my old Jazzmaster to get it. I had a 62 that wasn't expensive. I bought it in like 2001 or two, but I had to let that go to buy this Strat. So I sold my Jazzmaster to my friend, and it didn't take long to realize Strat wasn't right for me. I kept it for quite a long time.
Yeah.
And I was always trying to get my old Jazzmaster back. And I got it back eventually 20 years later.
Yeah.
But it cost a bit more to get it back, but it was well worth it.
And before we have you move on to a different instrument or back to one of these other ones, it's worth noting that Jay Maskus, it was a cool story you shared with me about when you opened for Dinosaur Jr., that he was the only time that you were opening band that got told to do what?
Oh, yeah. I met Jay when I worked in the guitar shop years ago, and he used to come in with Kevin Shields sometimes as well. And then we just sort of became friends and then kept in touch. And much later, maybe 2011 or something, we had we got to support Dinosaur on a UK tour. And I remember us getting to the Ritz in Manchester. It was maybe second or third show. Jay was watching a sound check, and we play a couple of songs, and he walks up to the stage and said, "You need to be louder, you should hook your amps together." Because I had the Super as the backup for the bassman, you know.
Yeah.
It's funny, there's pictures of us on stage at that gig, you know. My bassman, it's not a small amp, but like his amps are up here, you know, the three stacks, like the high watt and the plexis. And he just said, "Hook your amps together." And he said, "Our sound guy, Noel, will do sound for you." And Noel ended up kindly doing our sound. And really helped us out. But yeah, it's rare for a headline band to tell you need to be loud.
Sure enough, yeah. Well, right on.
I remember years ago doing a gig supporting Paul Weller, and their front of house guy said, "You're louder than Paul's band and the PA's not on." You know, that was Brixton Academy, but I didn't think we were that loud. I say we're medium loud, you know, we're not Dinosaur loud, but.
All right, there's one more guitar you want to talk about.
Yeah, this is a custom-built guitar that I designed and got made. I based it on a guitar that John Squire from the Stone Roses had, where I think he bought a couple of old 60s Fender Jaguars, but he got a different body shape built and changed all the pickups and the wiring. And it was a really great looking guitar. He had this white sort of custom Jag with a body that was a bit like a jazz bass, I think. And I always liked the look of that guitar, and I tried to do my own version of it. I had a few attempts. Actually, the first version, the body was bigger and it weighed way too much. And then I tried some different pickups and stuff, but I wanted the P90s really, because that's what I was familiar with, because I wanted something that could kind of cover some of the territory, although it's never going to do it exactly. But like a 330, in the fact that it had a Bigsby in the P90s, but I could throw it around a bit more on tour and not worry if we were flying or whatever. So that was the idea. I mean, it came out sort of brighter sounding guitar with a solid body and stuff, but I just wanted something that was kind of tough, but a twin P90 guitar that was, so it's kind of sits somewhere between, I guess, kind of what that Les Paul's doing and what the Jazzmaster is doing.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit of a thicker tone than the Jazzmaster, but it's still got some brightness. Thank you. can I put this in later on?
Yeah, what's that do?
It's Kill Switch.
Okay.
Okay, so I'm not the first person to do it. But I did a track with my band where I like that Beastie Boys tune, Jimmy James, where I don't know who was their DJ at the time, but they were sort of scratching and transforming with all sort of Hendrix sounds and stuff and samples. So I did a track just basically, I could do it with a fuzz box, but that kind of thing.
Nice.
So that was the idea behind that.
What song is that?
It's called I5CA. It was on the album Death Express. Now, I've used it subtly on other songs, and I've been doing a solo with the keys on tour, doing that with the Killswitch in a version of Next Girl.
Yeah.
I was playing that last year, so.
I wanted to bring it up with the Gold Top, but I'll do it here. Is what do you like about the P90s that is kind of your pickup choice?
I got into them later on because I always thought, you know, I like the sound of a humbucking pickup and stuff. It's great. They're a bit more kind of glassy and hi-fi, I think, but the thing I like about a P90 is there's something about the dynamic punch of it. Mm. They can be super fat, you know, but they're sort of, it's quite an expressive pickup, I think, and just the way it responds, I like the sort of either the fatness of it or the bark of it in a bridge pickup. A bit more kind of, a bit more barky than a bridge pickup on a, like a PAF type pickup. Mm. Yeah, there was just something about it where I just find myself going back to it, and especially with our band, I was playing the 330 more than the 345 sometimes. Whereas if I was doing sessions, I would take the 345 because it's less noisy. You know, if people don't want, it doesn't matter on our records if it's a bit noisy or a bit whatever, but for live situations, I would use that more. But I just got into it gradually over time and it just felt like home, really. Mm. And also people I liked, so like, you know, Paul Weller was playing his Casino, and then I see like the Stones, you know, in Hyde Park 69, Keith playing the 330. Just that sound, or early Les Paul recordings, you know, like blues recordings, or Al Wilson from Canned Heat, or any of those kind of stuff, Neil Young. Just the sheer, I mean, it's a powerful pickup, but you can get really sweet sounds, or like, you know, Grant Green on the Blue Note records, or whatever. I just love that tone. There's a certain pop to a P90, which is a real thing that I always go back to, and I just like the way it responds to how hard or soft you're hitting the guitar and stuff. So it's always a go-to for me, really.
Do you, the pickup position, do they look slanted, from my eye, was just that a kind of a experimentation?
It's just a vanity thing.
Oh, okay.
I just like the idea of it all being offset, you know, some kind of funky old guitar. The main version of this guitar is white, and it's got, the pickups are straight. So it's just a cosmetic thing, you know. I guess it's going to slightly alter the sound, but it's minimal, really.
Do you have any guitars that don't have a Bigsby or a tremolo arm?
The Esquire.
Yeah. Brian acoustic.
I have got an acoustic. My friend gave me a cool copy of a Gibson Hummingbird from the 1970s, a Japanese one.
Oh, cool.
And it sounds really great. I took that on tour with Liam and but a lot of the guitars, but I didn't get into the Bigsby tour later on, really.
Which one do you want here?
That one will do,
okay.
Anything, really. Thanks.
Yeah.
But I got into the Bigsby later on from a couple of things, really, because I didn't, you know, I like the way Jimi Hendrix used the Wang bar and certain people, but when I started working with Edwin Collins, the Scottish, as you know, he had that cool fuzz guitar hit with Girl Like You, where he was playing the fuzzed out Stratocaster with the Trem. But also British guitarist Bernard Butler used the Bigsby a lot, brilliant guitar player, like what he was doing. And Neil Young and Stephen Stills, really.
Neil wears it out.
Yeah, that was the inspiration, really. And just the sound of those, because I got into the early Crazy Horse records and then went back to the Buffalo Springfield records. And that sort of, that stuff that, you know, as well as Neil Young's stuff, Stills was doing, like that kind of, I don't know if I play this right now. Those kind of sounds, and I just like his thing with it, and I just realised it's a really expressive trem arm, really, and it's just got a mood. I know it doesn't alter the pitch that much, but it doesn't matter. It's enough to say, and I just found it really easy to use. And so I really got into these, and then I got into the Jazzmaster trem system as well.
Yeah, they're almost handier to grab because the arm is so much longer.
Yeah, although my old Jazzmaster one swings around, I need to secure that a bit. You know, sometimes it. I remember borrowing an old Jazzmaster when we were on the Charles Bradley tour, and we did a gig in, where was it? I think it was Minneapolis. And we got to the end of the song, and then someone shouted me in the audience, thought, are they heckling me? And it was this girl, she had the wang bar off the jazz master. Perfect. Got in the audience, she thought, oh, so, thanks.
That's a kind song.
Yeah, they could have run off it, because it wasn't my guitar either, so I borrowed it. But so yeah, it just became another thing where, another way of expressing things. It was cool with feedback, and it was cool with, you know, just getting, I don't know if I can get this to go now, but you could do subtle things with it or pretty nasty things with it. But it was just a nice feeling trem, and I like the way you can get a more kind of moody sort of country thing with it. Or yeah, I just like the mood of it, really.
Speaking of Bigsby, and I know this is not a Gretsch, but Duane Eddy, was he an influence on you?
Yeah, I like those sounds, yeah, definitely. And just that space in that music, you know, is really a cool thing. But it just makes you think how exciting a sound that would have been when it came out.
Yeah.
That and Shadows and all that kind of stuff. And later on, I discovered people like Cliff Gallup, you know, Blue Caps and things.
I bring up...
Brian Setzer as well.
Oh, yeah. I bring up Duane Eddy because I didn't know if there was a correlation or connection to the first track on your new record. Was it More Bad Miles of Road? And then Duane has a song, 40 Miles. 40 no. Bad Miles of Road.
It was a saying that someone had a version of that saying describing someone's face as being like so many miles of bad road. So I just wrote it like that, but I didn't know about the Duane Eddy song when I wrote it.
Okay.
But loads of people, even my mates in the band, were getting the song title mixed up and the words the wrong way around, but it's probably because of the Duane Eddy thing. I wasn't conscious of it at the time.
Yeah.
But it's not such a bad thing, but...
No.
But yeah, I wish I'd met Duane. He did a talk in my friend's guitar shop in Regent Sounds in London, but I wasn't around at the time. I would not have gone. But yeah, I love his guitar sound.
Well, let's move on to amps here. I know that we had kind of talked about what you have back home and what you use in the recordings, but what do we got here?
Well, these amps are built by Jason Turilli, our front of house guy on the tour.
It's nice to have.
He's an amp builder. He's built studio outboard gear, like I guess like mic pre's and EQs or compressors, and he maintains vintage equipment for Dan. He's also built a fuzz box that Andy Gabbard's using, which sounds amazing. It sounds like Spirit in the Sky. It's killer. And I used one of Jason's hand-built amps on part of the tour last year.
Okay.
And really liked it. So we've got these in for this tour, and they're sounding really good. This one is... Jason will tell you more about this, because I'm not as scientific. I'm not as sort of techie.
Yeah.
But this is kind of partly inspired by, you know, the early 70s Fender Music Master bass amp, the kind of tour with a single speaker in.
Yeah.
Part of the circuit is inspiration for this one.
Huh.
Although this has a 12-inch cone in it. I don't know what they had in. They might have had a 10.
Yeah.
I can't remember.
Me either.
And this is more voice like a Tweed Deluxe.
Okay.
To my
looks
knowledge.
The part.
Yeah. And we're just running them both together at the minute. This is, I'll turn this slap back off. So this is just the, just with the guitar turned down. That's the two amps together on their own. I just really like them, I like the way they respond. And so yeah, going to give these a go on the tour,
because
they sound really good and they feel like old amps. So
I mean, with him having, you know, hands on the faders out front and then having built these amps, I feel like it's a perfect guy to have run the ship.
Yeah, and he plays guitar as well, you know, and stuff. So, and he plays a bit of all instruments, I think. But yeah, I just tried one out at Soundcheck, because the lighting guy on the tour, he had Jason building one of these amps. And it was on the tour for a little bit, so I was using that one and really liked it.
Yeah.
And didn't really want to give it back. So this is a new one that Jason's built, and then he started building these smaller combos as well. So
yeah, I like the look of this. Both sound great, but I love the look of this one. This is such an eye catcher.
Yeah. I was instantly drawn to it by, you know, just purely superficial. I thought, wow, they look great. And then when we started messing around with them and playing them, I was like, sounds brilliant. And Jason seems happy about how they're sounding out front. So we're all going to be on different amps of Jason's, I think, on this tour.
Right on. Let's go through your pedal board. You kind of talked to me a little bit beforehand that this isn't very dissimilar than what you would tour with.
No, I'm not. I'm not a sort of, I don't consider myself a sort of pedal guy, really.
Yeah.
Although I've ended up using some, in the early days of the Little Barry Band, I didn't play any, I just played straight into an amp. But then we started to use a few different things in the recordings, like a bit of reverb or a bit of fuzz, and then, you know, boards started expanding a little bit. But this is a pretty basic board that can cover things. There's two fuzz boxes on this, which I don't always have. I do with a Little Barry Band, actually, with Malcolm, because I wrote one song using this second one. Mm. So that was a key part of the sound. But just a basic tuner to keep us hopefully in tune. And then this is the sort of solar sound of Wazzercraft Boss Tone Bender.
Mm-hmm.
Anthony Macari, whose family are the solar sound business and have been since the beginning, and had music stores in London since the 50s, I believe. Anthony's an old friend of mine, and he asked me if I would do the video demos when they did this collaboration with Boss, where they put a Mark II Tone Bender in a Boss enclosure.
Yeah.
So that's the pedal I got.
It's a killer pedal.
It's cool because it's convenient size, but I think it was a bit loud before I turned down. But it does the old Tone Bender thing, kind of a Yardbirdsy thing. So cool, kind of freak beat British fuzz.
Do you have a favorite version, or I guess lineup, of the Yardbirds?
That's a tough one. I mean, the Beck here is cool. I think the songs, maybe, but yeah, they're all good. I love the Yardbirds. I mean, they're a really important band. It was only later I learned how important they were to people in the US.
Mm.
When I played Primal Scream, we got to meet the guys from the MC5 who were still with us at that time, and Wayne talked about how much he loved the Yardbirds. I know people like Joe Perry really did. And stuff. The interesting thing about what Jeff was doing then, I suppose, was he was a real guitar maverick, and he was really pushing the boundaries, but he was putting cool things into songs, you know, and pretty futuristic, really. He was the most sort of futuristic and experimental of the British kind of hotshot guitar players, I guess, in the mid-60s.
Mm-hmm.
I loved what he did on Heart Full of Soul and I'm Not Talking and things like that. But, you know, they all played some great stuff, though. Like, the early live album's great, very iconic. And some of that live footage with Jimmy Page on, like, French TV stuff is killer. Like, where he's playing Over Under Sideways Down and stuff. I love that sound with the telly and the Tone Bender.
It's where it's at.
Yeah, so a lot of inspiration there, really.
What do we got next to it?
Next pedal is it's a clone of, it's actually got two versions of a similar circuit in it, but I'm just using it set on one of them. It's the Frederick Effects version of what I think is the Shinai companion fuzz, the Japanese fuzz, which I think is very similar, or if not the same, as the Univox Super Fuzz or the Shaftesbury Duo Fuzz. They were sold under different names, I think.
And the Shinai, I know they had several versions, but one that Dan actually used, one of the rig rundowns we might have done over 10 years ago, was like a fuzz wah. Do you know if it was the fuzz wah circuit, or if it's...
I think it might be the... I don't know, someone watching this will know.
Oh,
but
they will.
Is the fuzz circuit the same bit? That was the Jesus and Mary chain pedal as well, the fuzz wah version. But I got into these because I like the old Univox Super Fuzz sound when Pete Townsend used them with the Who at Woodstock and things like that. And also, I think it's the most brutal of the 60s fuzz boxes, really. But you can get, there's a couple of different tone settings on it, but I quite like turning the fuzz down slightly so it's not full gain, and you get this cool kind of blown out thing. There was a song that we haven't released yet, actually, that I've been playing with Lewis and Malcolm when we tour with his Little Barry, Malcolm Catto, with this pedal. This kind of goes. So yeah, I use it on a slightly more
that
subtle
is so
set.
So gnarly.
You can turn it all out and it'll be like, you know.
Yeah, with that sound, I think you'll fit in with the Black Keys just fine.
It's pretty rude pedal, you know, it's good. Yeah. I like that one.
And then you got three more, kind of more tamer pedals to the left there.
Yeah, the Strymon Deco I use if, you know, sometimes we're touring just practically with the little bow band. I can't get an amp like a White Bassman if we're going to places that are a bit more remote or further out where there's not the choice. Mm-hmm. So, and also playing with bands like there and with the keys, sometimes we don't play at a volume level where you're going to be able to crank valve amps all the way to get the tone you want, which is what I prefer to do with my band. So a couple of people got me onto the Strymon Deco, and I used the tape saturation side to sort of mimic a driven amp a bit more because it felt quite natural. I was always finding, with, I'm not a big fan of a lot of overdrive pedals. I find they sort of squash the sound or sometimes give you too much sustain sometimes as well, and they didn't seem to have the air that just a cranked up amp has. So I started using this. So clean the sound, and then so it sounds quite real to me. So yeah. I like that. And then the other side can do a bunch of things, do like a kind of tape flanging sound, I think, but I just use it for a slapback, more like a rockabilly. So yeah, handy pedal because it's small.
Just like Scotty Moore would have.
And I wish. But you know, push came to shove, I could probably do a gig with just that if I had to.
Yeah.
So it'd be all right. And then I'm not a big pedal person. Tremolo, so it's on the floor rather than having to rely on it on the amp, although I'd use it on the amp a lot in the studio. Built by Frederick Effects as well. He built the Super Fuzz thing. Just a simple vintage tremolo based on the old German Schaller pedals. Just a nice trem.
Yeah, I didn't know Schaller made pedals. I just know them for the hardware and the tuners.
Yeah, they made a killer fuzz box and a wah-wah pedal back in the day.
Huh.
I guess maybe they're easy to find in Europe.
Yeah.
But they do go for a bit of money now. But yeah, my friend had a Schaller fuzz that I used to use sometimes. He was good friends with Kevin Shields. Apparently Kevin liked those. But yeah, you do see them turn up sometimes for sale. But yeah, Frederick's a London-based company, but they make really cool stuff. So that's a nice simple effect. There's a lot of tremolo in Dada's stuff because it's, you know, quite sort of evocative guitar sounds.
Yeah.
Tremolo and reverb. And there's a reverb unit, which I don't always use so much with the keys when we're on stage, but it's a cool one that my friend Joe from Wolf People got me onto. Okay. Echo Fix, an Australian company. It's got a real spring inside. And it's got a, you can drive the spring in it, which is cool. So you can get like a, I'll turn it more extreme on. But with a spring drive on full, get kind of Fleetwood Mac-y sort of, you know, vibe.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty cavernous on full-on setting, but it will do the it'll do the Lee Perry if you hit it too hard. But yeah, it's a good unit that, because it sounds quite real, and I like the kind of grubbiness, the dirtiness of spring.
Yeah, there's cool. A certain liveliness to it
that
you can't get with like a digital reverb.
Yeah, and that's it really. I'm not a big effects person really. I'm quite happy when you've got an amp that sounds sweet and just seeing what you can get out of that. And then the other things are just a bit of colour if you want it.
Barry, yeah. I have one last question. Uh-huh. And I know that you've probably told this story a lot, but I figured this will be a treat and I didn't want to overshadow Gravity Freeze. Obviously a lot of people might know you're playing from one specific thing.
Yeah.
Better Call Saul, and I wanted to ask, so he did the Better Call Saul intro, great show, great intro, is when that happened, was it something that they approached you about based on like, because that song, Why Don't You Do It,
yeah.
Similar in tone and even chords in a way.
Yeah, the music director Thomas Golubich, who's based in LA, he liked Why Don't You Do It, and he asked if we would do something similar with that kind of guitar voice. And a similar BPM as well, and the brief was, we want a piece of music we can cut dead on 20 seconds to start each episode.
Yeah.
So that was the brief, and they wanted lots of different versions of something in a similar vein, basically.
With the limitation being 20 seconds.
Yeah. So we recorded the first, they asked for 17 at first. So we did, I wrote 17 themes. Then me and Virgil recorded them all and mixed them, because we could mix them super fast.
Yeah.
And just sent them off. And then they came back and said, yeah, they're great. Can you do another 12? So we did another 12. And that's how it came about. But yeah, they wanted that vibe. Sort of thing. So
that's got to be, you know, it feels pretty good that they sought you out in the sense that they were a fan, or someone was a fan, or heard it, or.
Well, Thomas was a fan, which is incredible, really, because we're not that known in the US, so it's like, you know, it's not exactly a big band.
Yeah.
So it's like, it was cool that he'd heard our records, he knew the songs, and there was no guarantees we were going to get chosen, because they were asking other composers as well, and. Mm. You do sometimes think that someone maybe who's already had more breaks in that world will get chosen because they're more of a reputation or a legacy or whatever, but they picked our theme, which was an amazing surprise. And it's been the best 20 seconds of music for us, you know.
Yeah,
someone said to us, does it bother you that people talk about it? It doesn't bother me at all.
Okay.
I love it. Yeah, it's great.
Good. Now, do you remember what number out of the, I think you,
number
by doing
seven.
The math, okay,
seven.
Out of the 20 some you did?
Yeah, it was number seven. I thought they would pick another one if they were going to pick us, but they didn't pick that one, so we turned that into a song on the Death Express record.
Okay.
Yeah.
Would you indulge me? Would you play?
Yeah.
Or at least show the people at home?
I'll try not to fuck it up now. But so,
It's all good, man. Now, how does that differ from Why Don't You Do It? Do you remember how to play
that
one?
Why Don't You Do It was... similar,
yeah.
You know, a bit more chordy, Why Don't You Do It, I suppose. But because that was a demo that I made on a four-track cassette machine, the original demo, Why Don't You Do It. I remember recording it with a bullet microphone, like a harmonica microphone.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't believe it when Thomas knew about us for a start and then knew about that song and was interested.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's been a cool thing. And that was the early days of me getting into using the Bigsby on back then as well, I suppose, when I wrote that song.
Yeah. Now, the last question would be, of all the different kind of roles and hats you've worn in the music world, whether it's, you know, being a guy in a guitar store, but also, you know, touring, band, recording, writing stuff for, sounds like you just did a documentary, a score for a documentary or
that
film.
That was during lockdown, actually, yeah.
Yeah, so where do you feel most at home, or where do you find most creativity gets kind of, you know, expressed?
So far for me, I think it's a combination. I mean, it's different when it's your own band, it's your thing, and it's your gang, and you're doing your own thing.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of good has gone back into that by me working with other people. And other people have brought things out of me that I wouldn't have done in my own band or by myself. So I think I'm the sort of person who works well with a combination of it, really.
Yeah.
Because I know some people who much prefer to just be studio musicians than touring musicians or vice versa. But I think for me, it's just whatever that balance is getting a little bit of each of those things, really.
Yeah.
And at a certain point, you're focusing more on one than the other. But, you know, it's all a blessing, really, I think, you know. To be an English guy coming out to Nashville, I had a chance to play. Like you were saying before, it's not as if they're short of musicians here. So it's pretty cool and get to play with Dan and the Keys, you know.
Well, it's pretty cool that I get to sit here and talk to you about guitar gear and music. So, Barry, I really appreciate
everything, man. I feel very fortunate.
Yeah, thank you for your time. And everyone go check out Gravity Freeze and all the other stuff he's put out. Thank you, guys.